they skip one or two taps, depending upon what's going on from the feed forward to the equalizer in the front, and the name of it's going to come to me, but it's not here yet. KTRIWK, 3J.
Joe recognized. Okay, Eric, thank you. And so I'll feel more comfortable when I walk into Radio Shack with a little red card that I got from my government. That gives me a $40 rebate on this $65 box. I got to give them $15 or $20, which is minor, in order for my old-fashioned analog television to continue to work beyond June 12th, because I'm still a little bit too cheap to go out and buy a real high-def television, which I should have done a long time ago. I've also got to fix some antennas on the tower so I get better reception. And I hope I will discover, and it doesn't matter too much, but I hope I will discover that the digital stream made by LG has an analog pass-through and also has a easy approach by which I could force it to go to a physical channel as opposed to a virtual channel. In other words, I'd like to be able to tell it, please go to channel 22 real right now. Don't do a scan. Just go to channel 22. Because I know the problem I'm going to have.
Eric?
Yeah, I'm going to get you in a second, Eric. And the problem I'm going to have is that I'm going to have a rotator on the tower with the antenna. And do I have four different memories for the four different scans for the four different positions of the antenna? KETWJ, go ahead, Eric.
Want to comment about this subject?
The first one is called the feed-forward equalizer. All right? It's an estimation scheme. It creates top selected correlation between the least mean square algorithm. So it kind of estimates the accuracy of the channel. Let's put it that way. The second one is called a decision feedback equalizer. That's the one that learns. That actually uses the timing of the symbol positions to make its decision. It also helps with signal noise interference, but on the startup, because the DFE has to learn what it's doing. So those are the right mechanisms, and that's approximately what they do.
Real fun. Among the people who signed into the TechNet, the guy who has, up till now, other than Eric, who works for a broadcast station, Channel 21 and Channel 13, as its chief engineer, the other person who has done the most amount of digital television reception experimentation, going out in the field, measuring signal strength, finding out how many channels are available and from his home in various locations, is Joe, R-Y-Y. And if I know Joe, he probably has tried more than one digital converter. So he may have some opinions as to who makes the best one and how well it works and how to best use it. Over to you, Joe. We got a lot of things to discuss tonight with you. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I bought a couple of Insignia boxes, which is what Best Buy markets them as. They're made by LG. It's the same thing as the Zenith DT901. It has auto scanning, which will simply just start and go through all the channels and find everything. It has what's called easy add. So after you do auto scan, you can do an easy add, and it'll update the list that's inside the thing. Because the one bad thing I found out what it does with auto scan, it will allow the zoom control inside the box. You can go like set by program, cropped, squeezed, letterbox. You can set it how it looks on a regular old analog television. Once you do the auto scan, it presets all those to set by program, and you have to go through each time and add that. I think it does set me on easy add, and it also has the availability of manually letting you go channel by channel and sitting there and seeing you can see a signal. You can look at the signal strike meter or graph from the bottom and actually get an indication. So I've got two of them. They work pretty good. And with the measurements I made coming off the antenna, if they can handle the broadcast signal from the Empire, where some are good and some are not good, it's not a bad thing. I think all of them are going to be subject to some sort of multi-pathing aircraft going overhead, things like that. Trees moving around your vicinity if you got like a marginal signal. But those, I have that one. I also have a Mitsubishi, but I don't use that one very much. But that was my comment directly with the subject.
Okay, Eric recognized Insignia DT901, and on a quick break show, where did you buy it? You told me, but I went by a little too fast with my notes.
ahead. Best Buy.
Best Buy sells the Insignia brand. To sell that. Probably Radio Shack, whatever they sell, is probably the same thing made by LG, like Eric said, just with a different name on the front of the box. They all have the same thing probably inside.
Okay, and Eric, is DT901 and Digital Stream a somewhat similar product? KE2EJ, KQLIW?
Okay, KQLIW, KE2EJ. If you look inside the boxes, and I've looked inside a couple of them, you can't actually tell whose box you're looking at sometimes. But yeah, those are the guys. And the thing that I wanted to add is that it's just coming into play now. I mean, it's part of the standard that's been set up a long time ago, but their broadcast is now beginning to implement something called AFD. It's a form of metadata, and what it stands for is an automatic format descriptor. And basically that tells the receiver whether you're looking at 4x3 or 16x9, makes the appropriate adjustments to the screen automatically without you having to select it. When you set up the box, initially, if you happen to have a 16x9 screen, you tell the box it's 16x9, and it kind of figures out what's playing and how to display it. So it removes operator intervention as far as, you know, trying to decide what the right thing to put up on the screen is, whether you should stretch it or make it letterboxed or display it as a full 16x9 picture. And slowly you'll begin to see some of those functions start to happen in the box that you haven't seen before. K2IWKE2DI.
Very fine. On a couple of occasions you talked about the real producer of the digital converter, LG, Lima Golf. Should I know what LG stands for, Eric? Go ahead.
I can't pronounce it. It's a Korean word. I think it's actually the guy's name that started the company. I could be wrong about that. I don't really know the correct answer to that, but I can find out. But how they got so involved with it is in 1989 or 90, right when Zenith was smack in the middle of developing the HBSD system, they came and bought them.
Stands for Lucky Gold Star, NCGO2.
Lucky Gold Star. I think Gold Star is another Korean popular brand, is that true?
Hey Dick, if you're asking me, yes it is.
So Lucky Gold Star.
Very good.
Okay, we're getting smarter. Slowly getting smarter about digital converters. I'm going to break down and buy one of these. We're all going to be using this or a real new television set real soon. And it's rather nice that the prices are coming down pretty fast. I'd like to believe liquid crystal screens are improving. I know that in the past, some of the highest resolution came from plasma displays, but the early plasma displays had a couple of disadvantages, which I think are slowly going away. If I was really going to buy a real TV set, Eric, what kind of a screen should I go for? Plasma, liquid crystal, TFT? What's the right kind of screen if I was a somewhat discriminating watcher who doesn't need 60 inches? To me, 30, 35 inches is more than enough. So I want a 35-inch screen, would like to not spend $1 zillion, but like to get some reasonable quality. Under those constraints, what would you go for, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW?
KQLIW, KE2EJ. Well, here's the thing. We've had this discussion before. In terms of choosing a TV set, there's a couple of factors which everybody has to deal with, and that's money. Okay, how much money you got to spend. And then, it's from a personal point of view, you may happen to like the way a liquid crystal screen looks as compared to a plasma, or you may like the way the plasma looks instead of the liquid crystal. I can tell you what I don't like about both of them, why I'm still a glutton for punishment, and all my TV sets, including my 16x9 sets, are tri-dot phosphorus CRTs. The dumb things weigh 202 pounds, the one that I happen to be looking at right here, but that's all in glass. But if you're patient and you wait until the end of this year, you'll see two new devices coming into play, which will be rather expensive at first. And of course, as mass production does mass producing, it's going to bring the cost down. Let it drop. The big improvements in liquid crystal that the consumer can buy today that the broadcasters have had for a while is two things. There's one which is called OLEDs, or organic LEDs. And the interesting thing about them is the purity and the spectral broadness of the light that they produce. And the other technology is 120 or 240 hertz refresh, which actually helps with some of the mosquito noise artifacts and a few of the other motion artifacts that the eyeball sees in liquid crystal. So in that domain, it's getting better. Plasmas, of course, are getting better in terms of they don't burn as badly, they're brighter, you get more black contrast out of them. But plasmas still have the problem of making what you would call a ramp, or a ramp picture, or a light that goes from bright to dark without putting lines in it. You get these what looks like quantization noise, because plasmas, in order to make grayscale, they dither. What they do is they use the dots nearby the dot of interest, and if to create a ramp or to create a step that goes from lighter to darker, they'll take one pixel and light up a couple other pixels not quite as bright to help make that look. Liquid crystals have a similar kind of problem, but they're a little bit better at resolving steps. So even though we're talking about digital stuff, in the end, we're making analog forms of light. So in these days, we kind of get around that problem by using filters. Optically, it's a little more difficult. I'm going to drop again.
Yeah, I think you're describing the luminance linearity problem. In other words, between the toe and the shoulder of the light curve, the plasma really is a kind of a two-state material. It's either off or on, and it's very difficult to get half brilliance out of a plasma. Is that sort of what you're discussing, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what they do with plasma is you can actually change the duty cycle of the pulse that you're using the light up to cell with. But it's still, there's a certain on point. You've got to reach a certain voltage before the gas conducts. Sorry, but it makes a certain amount of light when you hit
it,
you know.
So the non-linearity of the plasma, and plasma by definition is a negative impedance device. More current in some cases, more voltage sometimes it draws less current. So, or vice versa. You put more current through it, and the voltage drop can decrease. Yeah. That's what a plasma is capable of doing, particularly an arc plasma in air. And I guess the low pressure plasma that's in these little bitty ampules that are in the liquid in the plasma display. The plasma display itself must contain thousands and thousands of these little bitty neon bulbs. Isn't that essentially what it is, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, you can think of it as that. Actually, if you buy a Legion plasma, you'll get one that has 1920 cells on one line. Okay, and it'll have 1,080 lines of 1,920 cells, but it's really 1,920 cells times three, because one gas is red, one is green, one is blue.
Wow. The wiring on that, the connector on that focal plane array, on that display screen, obviously it's being fed in a digital manner with some kind of a multiplexing, but if that was all done with individual wires for X and Y, boy, would that be a connector. What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, well, I'm sure if you ever looked at your multimeter and took the liquid crystal display off of it, you'll see that actually that's your wiring into the glass. And then there's usually a transition between the glass and a connector. It's done by rows and columns, just like you would do computer memory. Actually, you just really, if you want to think of it as a 1920-bit serial shift register on each line. Load the whole shift register with the data and then pass it on and light up the gas or make the liquid crystal function. But it's more complex than that, because not only which pixel is how bright. So, you're really dealing with digital and analog all at the same time.
I see that. give us a couple of words about what you like and dislike about plasma, what you like and dislike about liquid crystal, and if you want to do it later instead of now because you've got some other family obligation, we'll understand. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, no problem. I did all the family stuff already. That's why I'm here. Okay. Well, the thing that I really hate about liquid crystals is the refresh time of 5 milliseconds is too damn slow. What that means, if you watch a race car going by, you see little pixels behind it kind of trailing off and making these little artifacts. They're kind of like, well, most people don't see it, but they annoy me. That's one aspect. Where the 240 Hz refresh does a much better job of doing that, and it brings it more into a bearable state of being. But let's start before the displays, because either we're getting our video from off the air, which would be APS-C, or we're getting it from cable, or we're getting it from satellite. Now, when I look at a picture that comes out of the camera and comes out of the tape recorder, it looks nothing like we get to see at home. I mean, it's like night and day in terms of the crispness and the quality and the lack of any kind of artifacts whatsoever. It's like looking through a really clean piece of glass or something. Unfortunately, to get it to the home, we got to squish the heck out of it. And the actual data rate of the HD that we produce for 1080i is actually 1.16 gigabits per second. And the maximum that we can actually stuff through a digital transmitter is 19.39 megabits per second, of which a certain amount of that is given up for sound, a certain amount of that is given up for the guides and data, a certain amount of that is given up for digital emergency alert service. So, you don't get 19 megabits. If you want to use the whole thing like CBS does, you get maybe 18 megabits. And we're starting out with something that starts at 1.16 gigabits. So I am damaged. I am really spoiled rotten because I know what we start with. I'm going to drop. So I have a prejudice in terms of what's out there. But based upon the scheme of taking that image and compressing it a minimum of 50 to 1 in order to get it to the house, you're going to have to buy it with something. In other words, you're going to lose something that starts out really nice. So now, my only choice is to pick something that does the least amount of damage to what I got left. So that's how I'm going to choose the display that I want to see. So I want to see a display that is as transparent as it possibly can be. You know there's going to be artifacts, but you don't want it to make the little artifacts worse, which a lot of things do. They have funny names for this stuff. Like, if you look at a digital picture that's, if you're lucky enough to have an HD set and they're playing in a standard definition commercial, and you'll know because you'll have the black wings on both sides. If you look at the lettering that comes up, you'll find things that look like little bubbles around it. We call that mosquito noise. That's an artifact. That's terribly annoying, especially when you're starting out with a lousy quality picture in the first place. So, it's those items. Plasmas are more annoying in terms of their ability to produce a nice analog rendition of a subtle night scene, let's say, where the sky goes from a light blue to black as the sun is setting. You wind up getting all these little jaggedy lines through it that drives me up a wall. K2RIW, K3J.
When it comes to the trailing picture problem with the 120 or 240 hertz refresh rate, I guess you're saying a movie like Grand Prix or the Indianapolis 500 that we had today, where some of that scenery is moving by at 230 miles an hour, I think you're saying that's where you're going to see trailing artifacts. Is that approximately true, Eric?
Yeah, somebody just popped in. I missed it. You got to actually separate what the monitor is doing from the transmission system, because if you're looking at the Indianapolis 500 and they're going around the corner, a camera swings and it pans from right to left really fast, you literally see the whole thing get fuzzy and break up, and it looks like it breaks up and becomes slightly out of focus for a moment. That's the transmission system doing that. So you get the transmission system doing that, plus what the monitor does. If you have a stationary background, you see the car moving really fast, and the background stays, so there you're going to see what the monitor is doing then, rather than what the transmission system is doing, because the transmission system can handle fast-moving small items within a static image, because there's a lot less number crunching that has to go on. And take pick whoever is broken.
Was there a person who had a comment? What do you know, Eric, about the nature of the camera that's mounted on the individual high-speed automobiles? A build of the Vita QGZ for a while was involved in that project of installing those cameras. I presume it's a wireless camera. I presume it has an entirely separate power supply, battery, and whatever. I mean, if that had to be wired into the main wiring system of the car, I can see how the driver and the owner of the car would probably object. But it's a thoroughly independent, small, light system, well bound down, so it's not going to go free and hit the pilot in the back of the head during a worst-case accident. I'd like to know, is that a high-def camera? Is that camera spitting out 1.16 gigabits per second and sending that over an RF link? And it's got to be a digital RF link, because I don't see any ghosting in those pictures that they pick up. So what do you know about those cameras? They look like they are rugged and doing an awful tough job. And they're remotely controllable to zoom in, zoom out, pan left, pan right, clean up the film that's out in front of the lens, and so on. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, it's been a long time since I was involved in doing something like that. I used to help out a friend of mine that owns a very large mobile truck organization, and that technology has changed over the years, basically. It depends upon who's providing the video services, because everybody has a different way of doing it. In terms of the physical structure of the camera and how it's mounted, I don't know if you've ever seen the way we shoot movies and stuff like that. We have these really incredible mounts that go on sides of cars, inside of cars, on the roll bar of cars. And generally, the cameras that we used to use, and this is what I was doing it before we got to high def, but they're basically lipstick cameras. The cameras are really no bigger than the size of a lipstick container. You've mentioned one that pans, zooms, and focuses, and that's a little bit bigger. We have the remote tiltable high def cameras that actually Sony makes for video conferencing. And they're actually quite small, and they have all the functions built in. And as far as the transmission system goes, pretty much everybody's using COFDM. Either it makes it or it breaks. Every now and then you may see a camera freeze. That's the nature of the transmission system. COFDM is a power-hungry method of transmission, but for things that are in motion, and if you reduce the bit rate of what you're sending, you can pretty much go 200 or 300 miles an hour and not really have to worry about tracking it so much and still getting a good picture out of it. K2RIW, K2RIW.
I should know. The OFDM, I think, is Orthogonal Frequency Division Multiplex. What does the C stand for of COFDM, Eric?
Coded. Coded, whereas at each hole on each part of the matrix has a function.
Fantastic. What a system. And so you think that's a lipstick-sized camera. Wow. So something that small, I can see how the driver and the owner of the car wouldn't object. With the battery, power supply, RF link, and everything else, what's your guess as to the size of the package that's being installed in those automobiles? And I tried looking carefully at cars that were pitted, and I don't think I saw the camera. I presume the camera is located, in many cases, in the top of the pylon, right behind the pilot's head. Over to you, Eric.
Again, it depends upon who's running the show, you know, how things are mounted. A lot of people have a lot of different ways of doing it. There's been sort of a standardization as far as, like, NASA is concerned, that I know. If you've ever seen a news guy out with his news camera, he's got a brick on the back of his camera. It's usually an Anton Bauer. That's usually the power supply for all this stuff. You're talking about transmitters that are less than a watt or around a watt.
The actual cost of the CCDs is like nothing. The support circuitry for it is next to nothing. It ain't nothing, but the biggest load is the transmitter. So these things are, you know, they're charged up, they're ready to go, they're put in the car just before the race starts. You know, part of the team is there ready to car, just, you know, clunking on the battery. And it just has to last the duration of the race. And that's it. And these batteries, these bricks, I think, I've got bricks that are good for about 20 amp hours or 15 amp hours. And they're usually Nike, they're kind of heavy. K2RWK.
Guess I'm a little bit amazed that they're not lithium, which would be a considerably higher energy density, yet rechargeable compared to nickel metal hydride or nickel cadmium.
I can tell you why.
In other words, someone's afraid of the explosion characteristics of rechargeable lithiums if you don't have just the right protection circuitry hooked in. And I can tell the camera's also mounted up high because I can always see the driver's hands steering the steering wheel at the same time you're seeing the road. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, the problem is you can't take commercial-grade lithium-ion batteries that we use on cameras. Sony makes some beautiful ones. You can't ship them by airplane. Yeah, shipping by ground or by boat, so people still don't use them because of that.
Okay, they're illegal to ship by airplane when fully charged for the reason of explosion characteristics and giving out noxious gases, giving out toxic gases when they explode or when they get shorted?
When they short, they explode. That's one problem. But so do NICADs. Not as badly. The reason why is they generate hydrogen gas at a rate that far exceeds the nickel metal hydride batteries, and put that in an enclosed space, mix it with a little oxygen, and you have a lot of noise on your hands.
I work for a company. One of my clients is a company that uses a lot of rechargeable lithium batteries, and quite often they've got a number of them being charged simultaneously in a charging rack along the wall of the main laboratory in this particular building. And one of those batteries decided to do something unpleasant one day. Even though each individual battery this company uses has a built-in protection circuit which does not let you overcharge or over-discharge, but still something went wrong. One of those batteries started outgassing, and they evacuated a building for a couple of hours because they were worried about the toxic fumes that can come off those batteries. So lithium, rechargeable lithium, we're talking about lithium hydride, lithium, I think it's called lithium polymer. Rechargeable lithium polymers, apparently, in the worst case scenario, are capable of putting out some pretty toxic stuff. At least the people running that laboratory believed that when they evacuated the building. Over to you for any comments on that, Eric.
Sorry, I was a little distracted. I didn't catch all of that.
Lithium polymer batteries, worst case scenario, when they start outgassing, I presume they can issue some rather toxic fumes. At least someone believes that in this particular facility where I work, where because of a recharged battery rack, a particular battery started outgassing, they evacuated all the people for a few, like 4 hours, they evacuated everyone out of the building until they checked for toxic fumes and brought everything back to normal. I haven't heard that lithium polymer is capable of doing that, but I guess it can be pretty pretty nasty stuff when it starts outgassing. Is that true?
Yeah, there's these things called lithium vinyl. It makes the equivalent of 5-gene gas. That I know about. The lithium polymer, I don't know specifically, but I assume that it's, you know, a polymer is a plastic. Plastics are not very healthy to burn, you know. So you have that particular sense of reality there in terms of what you're dealing with. Here you have a device with a lot of energy density in it, and a potential will make a heck of a lot of heat. So, you know, I don't know the exact answer to that, but that, we can find that out.
Okay, I'm going to let the machine drop now for quite a few seconds just to see if we've got Kent or anyone else out of area that wants to join us. And as soon as we come back on the air, we're going to attack, I put that in friendly terms, Joe's very interesting question of last week, a little bit on the technical side, of making ultimate sensitivity measurements under various conditions of a repeater system. We gave him a rather unsatisfactory answer last week, and we're going to try to correct that this week. But I'm going to let the machine drop for quite a few seconds, see if anyone out of area wants to join us. If so, give me your call letters right now, K2RAW in the TechNet. Okay, there being none, Joe, you bubbled to the top of our priority list. You're number one on the runway, and it's time for you to start spooling up your engines. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K2-R-I-W.
Okay, well, I actually have two questions. The second one is the carryover from last week to see if I did it right or wrong. I never remade the measurements. But the first question I have, this one is directed to KE2HA. Is there a particular reason why some of the offsets on the transmitters I've been measuring off the on the air, these DT signals I see, are, for example, some are like, say, .309.4 above the bottom end of the carrier. I've seen other ones at 321.1 below the bottom of the carrier. And your channel 21 is at 0.3325 below the bottom from the bottom end of the carrier. Is there a reason for the offsetting?
Yeah, there's a really good reason for that. Actually, on June 12th, you'll see all that go away. It'll be all even numbers at that point. Well, you'll notice that there's an offset when there's an adjacent carrier that's analog, like the 21 analog, it's 22 digital. You don't want that bottom edge sitting exactly where on the band edge where it's supposed to be, because it could start feeding into your sound carrier. So depending upon whether you have an analog above you or an analog below you, you're going to see an offset.
Good answer. Makes a lot of sense. I actually found that reason very handy this past week, because while I was watching digital TV, I had channel 21, the digital channel 21, actually on RF channel 22, it completely went away for a couple times during the morning hours. And I took my monitor receiver, my R7000, and went on 518.3094, and I saw another carrier there that was only about maybe 6 to 8 dB below your carrier. I have no idea who it was or where they were coming from, but they took out your transmission, because when they got to be within, say, 6 or 8 dB below your signal at 3325, they made your picture go away. So there was one hell of a good band opening this past week.
You're going to see a lot of that when the band opens. There's a 21 in the western part of Connecticut. There's a 21 in New Jersey. Or rather, a 22, actually. There's a 22 analog. There's another one in Rhode Island. So, you know, at least in the analog world, you can just measure the frequency of the bars and know where the station's coming from, because everybody has an offset. Or you don't have an offset, and you just look it up, and you can figure out where the offending station is. Digital, it gets a little more complicated.
You're saying there's a digital 22 from New Jersey also?
Yeah, along those lines, Eric, how many of the channel 22s that you know of within, let's say, a 100-mile radius of us are either digital or analog? Are the majority of them analog on 22? Over to you, Eric.
If I was at work, I could tell you exactly. I have a little piece of paper. It's got them on the map. I think it's like three or four that within 150 miles.
Three or four analogs, and are you the only digital you know of on 22?
At the moment.
Good to know. And we're not going to pin you down to that, because you don't have your magic piece of paper in front of you. You got a joke.
Okay, then the additional 22 I was picking up had to come from way out of the area, and whatever it was coming strong enough to take out your transmitter out in Sayville. So that's a pretty good signal ratio of taking some out, wouldn't you think, Dick?
Okay, as a 432 single sideband operator, and 517 is not that far away, 521, when I get a band opening on 432, I have seen, for instance, the Fort Lauderdale area of Florida come through on 432 with signals that were as strong as a guy that was 30 miles away from me, and the signal hung in there for 24 solid hours one summer. I've also seen signals on 432 from Chicago, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa. I've only seen them for a couple of hours at a time, but super strong. When you get tropospheric ducting, forward propagated tropospheric ducting, or super refraction phenomena, you can get a signal out of area, 1,000, 1,200 miles away, and you'll think that signal is in your backyard. So Mother Nature can do that.
Hey, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, about 3 weeks ago, there was a bit of an opening around, I think, around 10 o'clock at night. I had one of the Boston stations for about 3 hours. I picked up a New Hampshire station. So the digital is interesting DX-wise, where it comes in, it's like it's next door. I mean, it goes away. You can see it on a spectrum analyzer, but once it reaches that threshold, it's like, it's next door. That's the weird part about it.
Eric, when you were seeing those Boston and New Hampshire and Vermont or whatever signals, I presume you were watching a digital signal, but was it on a normally blank channel that you did a scan and found it during that period of time? Or was it so darn strong that it took out some other digital that was on that channel? Over to you, Eric.
No, actually, I happen to hear the UHF repeater come in that I don't normally hear. So that clued me in. And at work, I keep the spectrum analyzer hooked up to the rotable antenna, so I could actually see it. And the kind of receiver I have, I don't have to train. It's a broadcast receiver. It's only a third-generation equalizer, but I just dial in whatever frequency I want, and it goes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to giving Joe some challenge when it comes to digital television DXing. I've got a yardarm, or a sidearm, sitting off the side of my tower at about the 70-foot level on one of my towers. I'm the guy who walked into Radio Shack in Deer Park when it was still there, I guess 6 months ago, and I said, in your catalog, you used to have this deep fringe antenna, VHF, UHF antenna, this great big long thing. You got one of those? That guy says, yeah, we've had it in the back room for a zillion years. It's covered with an inch of dust. I said, well, take the dust off and sell it to me. And he looked at me like, don't you realize that digital television is coming in and people are not going to use these things anymore? I said, yeah. I said, you don't know where this thing is going, and I'm going to use it. And I bought it from them. They looked at me pretty strangely. Over to you, Eric, for any comments on that one. Okay, Eric's gone. Joe, you got the floor. H-U-L-Y-Y. Wouldn't you like to have a rotatable deep fringe antenna where I'm going to mount it? It has line of sight to Empire State Building from out here in Huntington. So from the top of my tower, I wish I could put it up on the top. Maybe I can. I can see across the Long Island Sound into Connecticut visually, and on a good clear day, I can count 51 buildings in Manhattan, and I can see the shoreline of New Jersey, so I ought to be able to do some nice television DXing if I can put it all together. So H-U-L-Y-Y, H-U-L-I-W.
Look at the ground elevation, look at the antenna height you have above me. The only thing I have an advantage near me is I'm maybe 2 miles from the water, but besides that, you got me beat hands down. I couldn't possibly compete. You have an ideal installation for TV DXing. I wouldn't be surprised if you can start getting stations 100 to 150 miles out minimum all the time with your installation once you start going full bore.
Yeah, but with those long ranges where you get serious multipath, I guess whether or not the equalizing network of the digital converter can handle all that, and whether or not the modern set, in fact, there's a question when Eric comes back, I'm going to ask him, that LG Super Duper, I guess what was it called now? You called it a model number, can't find it on my crazy notes here now all of a sudden. Anyhow, you gave it a model number, DT901, among others, Insignia, and he likes a digital stream, but they're all LG fifth generation. I'd like to know whether or not fifth generation or higher generations are in the real front end tuners of the sets that you can buy these days. I'm eventually going to be asking Eric that question. Over to you.
Yes.
Okay. You're saying those converters are in the sets right now, fifth generation? And is there a seventh generation coming down the pike? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, K2RW, K2J.
Sony, LG, Samsung, same as LG. A couple of the Chinese manufacturers now actively producing receivers that are built into the sets with fifth generation chips. They're still depleting the stock of the older stuff, though. That, you know, it's going to take a little while before they all become fifth generation equalizers. By that time, they'll be on the seventh generation equalizer, which I didn't get to see, but they showed it at NAB. I didn't get to go this year because of economic reasons. I know a few other folks went, and they told me about what they saw. Now, the other thing is when DXing, any kind of noise, impulse noise, anything random is enough to make your equalizer go nuts and unlock. So if you got something that's there consistently, once it unlocks, it ain't going to lock again until whatever the conflicting signal is that's disturbing the symbol. K2RWK2, yeah.
I presume some of that disturbance you're talking about could be local arc over of a 60-cycle power line. I think that can aggravate it, which is a VHF, lower VHF problem. Upper UHF, it's almost gone, and upper VHF, it's almost gone, and UHF, I'd like to believe, it's falling off 12 dB per octave, 60 dB, 12 dB per octave, I keep forgetting the number. So as you go to higher UHF channels, that should become better. I guess co-channel interference, how good is digital on co-channel interference, Eric? In other words, if I'm watching A channel 22, and I'm watching the one from Plainview, and one comes through some number of decibels stronger because of super refraction, and it's coming in from the Chicago area, how many decibels of difference in co-channel interference on digital is required for fifth generation to handle it? And when you're at the National Association of Broadcasters show, when your buddies were there, were they able to quantify how much better seventh generation is over six, over fifth? There's a couple of questions in there. Over to you, Eric.
K2RWK2J. Well, there's something called EVSB or Enhanced VSB, which is designed for mobile service. The demonstration was given in a moving vehicle between a seventh generation equalizer using a four-way VSB and the mobile EV VSB that was being transmitted, and the 7th generation equalizer worked quite well, not as well as the EVSB, but mile better than the 5th generation equalizer. So it's all relative. It's really not intended for it to be a mobile service, where Seal FDM has a better chance of that. The differences in the equalizers not as profound as you might believe. You know, every step is never a major leap once you get a, once you work on an algorithm, you essentially refine it. You know, how much effort does it take to make a 1% improvement? You have that kind of thing going for you. But the hard part with DXing, of course, is that if you have two signals on the same channel, one's got to be sufficiently stronger than the other one to make the other one disappear, and that takes a lot. But if you have, if you are next door to, say, channel 21's transmitter, or the transmitter on channel 22, and you are getting a strong signal from 21 from somewhere, right, herein lies the problem with many of these receivers, is front end overload. Overload the front end, you're dead. You've got co-channel signals. You'll find when you look at them on a spectrum analyzer, they're lined up next to each other. At first glance, with the normal bandwidth resolution, it looks like you basically have a straight line across three or four channels. But in essence, you'll find that the mass filters on the transmitters are rather precise, and the bottoms of those signals don't touch each other. So, given that you're not causing the receiver any kind of ADC overload, you can discreetly have no problems with co-channel. I think that the figure, I'm going to kick it off the top of my head, it could be miles away from where it is, but I think it was in the order of something like 40 to 45 dB, something of that nature, before the front end starts to go mushy. K2RWK2J.
Okay, if you set 45 dB of stronger on the adjacent channel when you're listening to a weak one, could you give you grief? I'd certainly accept that. And by the way, when you do read this article in Electronic Design News, May 14th issue, and on, it starts on page 20, I think it is, yes, you'll see that he decided to use a preamplifier in order to overcome the 10 decibels of loss of his cabling within his house. And when he used a Motorola 20 dB gain amplifier, it created overload and some of his channels disappeared on him. He then went over to an Antenna Direct brand name preamplifier that had less gain and less cross-modulation characteristics, and some of that got cured. Considering all the details he went through, when you read his article, boy, he went through a lot of rigmarole to get good television reception from two separate mountains that are in his area where he lives in, I said Colorado, it's Nevada, I think it is where he lives. And even though those channels are only 20 miles away, he had a fair amount of grief. In his application, even though he gets ice loading in the wintertime, I would have been very tempted to put up one good long antenna, highly directive antenna, with a rotator. He wanted everything to be small, unobservable, fixed locations and whatever, so he came up with some kind of a more elaborate scheme to get his particular channels, and he still had to sacrifice some of them. I think the better solution, as I said, would have been to just give up, put up a big antenna and a rotator, and recognize the fact that very few people look up in the air when they visit you. They're not going to see whether or not you've got a so-called ugly antenna on the roof. And even if they did, let them complain. You can say, yeah, but look at the picture I get on over-the-air broadcast, and I'm not paying for it. When it comes to the deals that are coming down these days where various television sets go on sale, I guess in some cases they're selling older stock, discontinued models that have earlier versions of the third and fifth generation equalizer inside. Is that a good guess, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, I haven't found a place that I couldn't make something work. And there's always a way to make something work, but sometimes you have to bring some gear with you to see what you're working with. But for the average smell, the best thing to do is put an antenna on the roof, but it doesn't end there. You got to get it pointed in the right direction. Maybe after the 12, it'll be less of a touchy issue than it is now, but there are going to be certain channels where it's going to be a touchy issue, and it depends upon the receiver you have. As the receiver technology gets better, it becomes easier to do what it is that we're doing. But, I mean, if the guy's only 20 miles from the broadcast tower, a big tower of low-level antenna is a little much, but it does add to convenience. So, but given more time, given more R&D on the equalizers and receivers, it'll get better still. K2LAW, K2J.
Understand. The 40 dB you spoke of earlier, is that possibly the number of decibels required if I have true co-channel interference? In other words, assume that nothing in the world but channel 22 exists, and I'm watching a local channel 22, and a far-off channel 22 starts coming through stronger. What's a rough guess as to how many decibels stronger the one I want to watch has to be than the one I don't want to watch? How many decibels of difference is required on true co-channel interference? And we're not discussing any adjacent channel, any other adjacent strong signals or whatever. Nothing there but that particular co-channel. How many decibels of difference is required for the converter, in your best guess, to be able to sort it all out? K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. My best guess is, okay, now here, let's talk about some realities here. What's the minimum signal level that the receiver, going to kick off on? I switch over to DBMV here because those are the numbers that most things are rated and on the receiver side, so numbers sound a little bit different, but really good sets start to walk off at about minus 14, minus 15 DBMV, not DBM, DBM in microvolts, okay, millivolts, that is right. Whereas 60 DBMV is a volt. There's the reference point. That's the threshold of receiving. As long as you're not whacking out the front end of the receiver, which means you're going to be putting like 60 into it, DBMV, which is a volt, or a half a volt,
you're not going to have trouble tuning and getting either station. Once you start to saturate the front end, because most of these boxes really don't have much of a front end, it's rare that you even see them with an RF stage in them, because they've got to go from 50 megahertz to, you know, 700 megahertz. That's a heck of a lot of bandwidth. So. And they tend not to switch different front ends in and out today. They tend to do things in brackets to keep the cost down. So those are really your limiting factors. So, I guess, you know, when you finally whack the front end, you got to be hitting at least, 45, 50, 55, something in that neighborhood. So if you're going to deal with that 55 number, start at minus 18, work your way up.
Yeah, well, you mentioned minus 14 dBmV. That calculates to be very close to 0.2 millivolts. 200 microvolts. Wow. On a 70 ohm system. That's a lot of carry the noise ratio by my standards. I mean, pretty soon Joe's going to tell us about his 0.2 of a microvolt sensitive converter. And here we're talking about 200 microvolts. I know we're talking about 6 megs of bandwidth as opposed to his noise equivalent bandwidth of some number of kilohertz. And that makes a 30 decibel disadvantage in signal strength. But still, wild. So you believe minus 14 to minus 15 dBm is the signal-to-noise ratio, carry-to-noise ratio threshold for a good digital converter, if I understand you correctly, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I gave you that as an average number. There's some that go down to minus 22 or minus 24, so, you know, you can calculate it. But you're talking about an energy over a 6 megahertz signal, not a single carrier. But people are going to mess up that measurement, because if you look at field strength meters that are designed for this type of work, they actually average across a 6 megahertz bandwidth. So it looks at the signal strength of the whole channel per se, rather than a single point carrier that gets the bandwidth of zero if it's just a carrier, you know.
Yeah, there's my next question. If I had a brick wall filter, 6.0 megahertz wide, and I looked at the total energy of a digital signal, and I come up with a number of minus 20 dBmV, is that a true RMS number that I would see in a real measurement, or is some other fancy calculations going on involving peak envelope power and crest factor and whatever? Is that minus 14 or minus 20 dBmV measured across 6 megs a real RMS power? Over to you, Eric.
Well, I did say average, but it is actually multiplied by 0.707 as far as, you know, it depends on the measuring device you're using, because they have them in peak indicators if you're using an analyzer-type device, which has a visual display. And it's RMS. If you're using a meter, you know, the cable guy goes out with a little cable meter. That's the device. It measures across the 6 megahertz, gives you an RMS value.
Yeah, I know we've got an additional calibration problem goes on here between a broadband signal versus a CW signal, the way logarithmic amplifiers behave, the way a square lower crystal detector behaves, and so on. We got a bit of a conversion problem going on here. A logarithmic IF amplifier, log IF amplifier in a spectrum analyzer, for instance, does suppress noise compared to carrier when you're putting in a pure carrier. So what you measure on the screen is 2 and a fraction decibels better, more optimistic, and carry the noise ratio than reality because of the way the nonlinearity of a logarithmic IF behaves. So we got a conversion problem going on there. But after I remove the conversion problem, I think I'm sensing that a 6 meg brick wall filter into a properly calibrated device, we're talking about true RMS power of minus 14 dBm of apparent carrier to noise ratio. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll go with that. That's a fair number. Most of the manufacturers, actually, I think they specify minus 10 as their starting point, whereas
of desired signal. When you go and in the analog days, because the digital world is different. There's different people have different ways of saying it now. But in the analog world, it was desirable to have between minus 10 and 0 dBmV into the antenna connector of your TV set. So that should give you a little hint where the world is at.
Okay, that minus 20 versus the minus 14 is 100 microvolts instead of 200 microvolts. But I've got to compare that now to a 6 meg bandwidth instead of a 6 kilohertz bandwidth. I've got to compare that to the signal-to-noise ratio that's required. In the old analog days, you'd like to have 45 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio in order to have a essentially snow-free picture. And I presume the true demodulated carrier-to-noise ratio doesn't have to be anywhere near that good with digital television, obvious by the fact that each one of the digital broadcast transmitters are running significantly less average power compared to the old analog systems.
Well, it's 45 for analog and it's 27 for digital.
Wow. 45 versus 27. So that is 15 and 3, 18. It appears as though digital television has an 18 decibel advantage. Does that mean you could make, in theory, 15 decibels less transmitter power and still have the same grade B coverage area? Over to you, Eric.
All right, I'll give you a real-world example. The output of my transmitter is, let's say, 60 kilowatts, okay? The gain of the antenna is 17 dB. So, what's the ERP based on those two sets of numbers?
I'll come back in about 10 seconds. I got a calculator in my hand.
And why do you think I put it to you that way?
WA5BJB, check again.
Hello. There's the man from Cedar Hill, Texas. Grand Prairie, outside of Grand Prairie, very close to Dallas-Fort Worth. 60 kilowatts. I think is around plus 77, plus 78 dB with reference to a milliwatt, dBm. I may have had that one wrong. Yep, I think that's it. And 17 dB of antenna gain is 94. I think your effective isotropic radiated power is 94.8, 94.7. I do know that I went through the set of calculations for the receiver on the P-1 bomber, because we were worried about what would happen if we flew over a certain area of Europe that had a fair number of high-power UHF television channels. And for that particular frequency region, what would happen to that receiver? And I needed a video signal that had a particular duty factor to it in order to simulate this. I chose the movie, what was the name of that Walt Disney movie that had a bunch of these... It was a computer-generated movie with a bunch of motorcycles. Everybody knows that movie. What is the name of it?
Cars.
Say again?
Cars.
Nope. I don't think so. There was a... This is 20-some-odd years ago. A Walt Disney-made movie, which was a kind of a game plan.
Tron?
Tron. That's it.
The Mad World.
That was Tron. So I chose the movie Tron, put it through a NTSC... modulator, adjusted the power to the right frequency, the right power output, poured it into the front end of the receiver to find out what would happen. And the bottom line is we had to make an improvement to the receiver to tolerate that signal. So I think you've got something in the vicinity of plus 94, 95 dBm effective isotropic radiated power coming out of your UHF channel. That is your analog, I presume, you gave us, and I presume a considerably smaller number is going to be used for digital. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
All right, K2IW, KE2EJ. Now, I give you on a map, don't forget, we've got a peanut pattern, but that's irrelevant. I give you the same grade B coverage, okay, and the values are 4.78 kilowatts and an antenna gain of 13 dB.
Okay, be back in a second.
Oh, by the way, the coverage maps are figured out mathematically using Langley Rays, and there's an FCC version of it that that takes the difference between analog and digital into consideration and adds an offset based on that. Okay, cool.